Crab Feast. You know what it's all about.
This is the Crab Feast. I'm yelling, fuck that. You ain't gotta ask me, cause you can trust that. Every Tuesday, you already knew though. Ryan Sickler, soccer star, JUCO. Above ground, cool goes better than most. Jay Larson, self-diagnosed. Go down low this week, last week. Here we go again, fuck the Crab Feast.
It's the job.
Welcome back to the Crab Feast, y'all.
Yes.
Another two.
We did it.
Another Crab Feast with that ass.
Yes.
Good to touch your pitch. Yes, Jay Larson.
Good to touch yours, Ryan.
Thanks.
Great to be here on this special Tuesday. Always a pleasure to be here with you.
Always a pleasure.
Feaster Nation, great to be here with you. Jay Larson here, jlarsoncomedy.com, Jay Larson Comedy on all social media. This week, I'm in Colorado, the 20th, 21st, and 22nd. I've listed that to you guys before. A bunch of different spots, all available on my website. If you go over there, that's available. And then October, I'm coming out to Cleveland on the 3rd, Detroit on the 4th, Chicago on the 5th, Fort Wayne on the 6th. 10th in Portland, the 11th, I'm going to be in Tacoma, the 12th, I'm going to be in Wenatchee, the 13th, I'll be in Petaluma, 14th in Oakland, and then later in the month, I'll be back out on the road the third week, and then into November. All dates available at jlarsoncomedy.com. I've been posting on social media as well, so please, if you're in the area, bring some friends, come on out. I'm going to do a lot of crowd work, some new material to go with that crowd work, but it'd be great to see some feasters out there, so I hope you can make Sickle Cell.
Ryan Sickler on Instagram. Go follow me on Instagram. I'm putting real work in there, guys. And all social media, RyanSickler.com. I just want to keep thanking all of you for the, I guess it's an outpouring of love, because it is nonstop, man. You guys really are fucking awesome. We're reading through as much as we can. And
so many emails.
Yeah, thank you so much. And stop fretting. The Crab Feast is having two babies. You're going to get two new crab, or excuse me, I'm such... So used to saying it. Two new podcasts every week. And make sure you support us and follow us when we get there. But we still got some Tuesdays left, y'all. And before the end of the year, Baltimore, Saturday, November 17th, at the Famous, Jimmy's Famous Seafood. Josh Adam Myers is joining me. I will be there. You better get your tickets now. I'm not kidding you. They're already, we got a good chunk of them already sold. So it's going to sell out. Get your tickets now. You can get them on my website at RyanSickler.com. They're also up on thecrabfeast.com. Make sure you follow us on iTunes, Spotify, Laughable. It always matters, y'all, every Tuesday. And merch, we still got some shirts going right now.
Yep.
Got
today was the last day, I think.
For Kentucky or Master Charge.
Master Charge.
And we are going to be putting up Tuesday, FTCF. Yep. So you guys will be able to get those. And the good thing about that, going through Bonfires, you'll be able to get them in your own colors, sizes, can, styles,
yeah,
all
mix
that
mix and match.
Yeah,
you can do whatever you want.
When they hit, you better jump on those. And make sure you subscribe and follow the Crab Feast on Facebook and Twitter. You'll get all your news there. Speaking of news, we got some industry news on this episode.
We got some industry news.
Some great
stories. This guy's industry deep. Very funny guy, very interesting guy. We're excited to have him on for the first time. Comedy royalty, please welcome Mr. Barry Katz.
Barry Katz,
welcome to the Crab
Feast. Welcome to the Crab Feast.
Crap, that's impressive.
Welcome,
nice,
Barry,
right?
Katz. Doesn't that feel good?
That feels so good. This operation is incredible here. You know, people don't understand. Like, they think podcasting is, you know, you just get this little equipment that's like this 3-inch thing that you just bring with you and you just do the thing and pass the mic back and forth. But you got like a whole setup here, like a great lamp from IKEA overlooking
the
table.
So that is not
offending
IKEA.
Jay now. It's probably going to say it's a mid-century,
I
a.k.a. 1950s.
That's a mid-century knockoff is what that is. But this is how you know you have a nice guest. Normally, we have comedians coming here and be like, what's this fucking dump, dude?
Shit on the place.
Dump. You got a weed shop across the way. I got held up in the parking lot. Barry's like, wow, this is, you guys got a great operation.
You have an operation. You're doing it.
We decided to reinvest in ourselves, and it's working, yeah.
Bet on yourself.
That's
I always say bet on yourself.
I mean,
heck. Well, you know, too, you've been around comedians so long, you know how degenerate, like, comedians will live 10 deep in a studio apartment in New York if they have to.
I've seen many situations like that that blow me away.
Yeah.
Blow me away. I mean, so many stories of that and people who have lived in compromising situations. I mean, Tracy Morgan, when I first met him, incredible situation where he was living in the projects. I remember the street, Loring Avenue.
And that was my grandfather's name.
And he was
it? Loring Larson, yeah.
And he was living, he had four kids and his girlfriend, and they were on some kind of welfare or something, and, you know, bullets flying left and right. And I would go to see him at the Uptown Comedy
Club. So what were you doing at the time?
I was a manager at the time, and I also owned the Boston Comedy Club.
I mean, hold on.
Yeah, because we need to introduce you you have these great stories about these. But so before we do, please promote anything you want. Your podcast, your social media, websites, books, whatever. Whatever
clients.
You have. All of it. Clients.
Imagine.
One of the worst things about being like the only manager or producer or whatever who has a podcast is the fact that even though when I represented Dane Cook, we essentially, with his talent and mine and incredible gifts of how his vision was, we started social media for artists. And so to the point where he could press a button and sell out Madison Square Garden two times in one night.
It was twice in the same night?
Oh, yeah. He did that twice, and he did Boston Garden twice. The only comedian or musical artist who's ever done that.
Or musical artist?
No musical artist does two shows in one night. Nobody would do that. So you're talking about 40,000 people in one night. One weekend, he did them back-to-back. So he did like 80,000
people. Wait, he did Madison Square Garden
one weekend. The next weekend he did Boston Garden, and he did 80,000 people in a span of 1 week. It was insanity. But for me, as a manager, those who can't manage. And so I can't promote myself, so I don't. The only thing I'll say is at Barry Katz, and you can
and
find
your podcast.
There.
But your podcast.
And the podcast is industry standard, and it's free like yours, and I've interviewed everybody from Kevin Hart to Caitlyn Jenner to the president of Netflix to David Copperfield, you know, so many different people about their journey from humble beginnings and how they got to the next level and their advice for people all over the world. And
yeah.
Luckily it's, I don't know how, but it's just taken off and it's gone crazy. And I do these things at lunchtimes and I edit on Sundays. And
yeah. I love that you're into it. You're into it. I see you caught that bug.
I'm really into it because I'll tell you why in your audience. It's because when you're a manager and you guys have representation, like I've represented six people on Saturday Night Live. Let's just take that as an example. So if you're in the situation where you are working hard with their talent for them to get Saturday Night Live and they get the show, you go home and you're like, you can't believe it. It's just the greatest. You know, one of the greatest shows on television, Lorne Michaels, just a genius. But you sit at home and you think to yourself, well, you know, I've only really helped one person. I've only done, Lorne and NBC and, millions of people watch the show and are entertained. But in the scheme of being a manager, I've only, with my talent and theirs, I've only helped one person. And the podcast, you can get on and millions of people mm-hmm. can listen and they write you and they tell you these amazing stories about how things have helped them. And yes, I love that. I can't get enough of it.
Yeah. Me too. I love it. I love it.
Let me ask you, how did you get to become a manager? Did you know? Where'd you go to college?
I went to college at Boston University.
BU, he's a terrier. And you grew up in
Long Island. They're terriers?
The terriers, baby.
I thought they were the Golden Eagle.
That's Boston College.
Oh, Boston College.
Okay, my bad. BU Terriers. And then what'd you study there?
I worked with disabled kids and adults. That was my lane. When I was 15, I was working in camps for disabled kids and adults, and I became like a phenom in that world. I was recruited by the greatest outdoor camps and recreational facilities for disabled. not Paul Newman's camp. Okay. But I was recruited for a camp in Bedford, New Hampshire, which was the number two camp in the country called Camp Allen. And then I was recruited for the number one camp, Camp Riley. Do you happen to know the two famous comedians who were born in Bedford, New Hampshire?
Yeah. I'll say Adam Sandler and Sarah Silverman.
You are correct.
Well done, baby. Man. I went to school in Manch Vegas.
What does he win? And so I did that. And so, but what happened was, is, like you guys, I experienced tragedy when I was younger. My dad passed away when I was four. And, you know, the pain you see on a parent, you know, throughout those times, I would.
Was it, can I ask you, was it your fault? Because Rye killed his dad. I just want to know how close.
It was not my fault.
Okay, okay.
It was not my fault. I'd like to hear that story. And so, yeah, and so you.
Wrong left turn, that's all.
I mean, my mom doesn't want to hear it, but she and stress killed my dad. I just made a wrong left turn on the way to the hospital. We'll come back to that.
Okay, that's. And he's laughing about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, well, you got to.
He was alive for a while after that left turn. It wasn't that left turn that did it.
Incredible. When you say that, the biggest thing I take from what you say, even though you're laughing, is I always think about the way fate works. So it's like if you're, let's just pretend, who is driving that day?
Me.
You were driving.
Yeah.
All right. So let's just pretend you were driving that day and you're walking out of the store, you're about to get to your car and you drop your keys and then you just, pick up your keys. And then your whole life changes differently and nothing happens.
By that millisecond.
That's what's so amazing about life. And it's true in our business as well, because what people don't understand about the business, and I'll get back to how I got into comedy, is that our business is a game of inches, and it's a game of fate and how things go and being in the right place at the right time, not just creating your own content and doing your own thing, but then presenting it in a way, in a time frame where it all gets to where it's supposed to go and the right people see it at the right time. And that's what people don't understand. Like, you can audition for SNL. Look, I represented Melissa Villaseñor for 8 years. She tested for SNL twice. Okay, didn't get it. 5 years later, she got it. Now, would she have gotten the show had she not gotten the show twice before? You know, it's the way the things work. Jay Moore, when he got Saturday Night Live, I mean, it was almost flukish the way he went on stage and he did it. He was wearing shorts and a t-shirt.
On stage.
Of course. And he wasn't even prepared. He didn't even want to prepare. He couldn't even conceive of the fact that he could get something like that. It wasn't even in his mind that he could do it. But that night, particularly, he remembers that Farley was in the crowd, and along with Lorne Michaels, and I believe, I forget who else was in the crowd.
Oh, sometimes they would sit in and watch, like even the cast, current cast.
And Marcy Klein going up to him and saying, you should talk to Lorne. He's like, I don't know, you know. And so, because he was 19, so you don't know.
He's baby.
But at that time when he got on the show, again, timing is everything and how you navigate and how you handle things. So he's on there. He's talented, but he doesn't have the tools in his emotional toolbox at 19 to be able to deal with what goes on there.
Yeah.
And so whereas Melissa, you know, whether she – I think she's going to do really well and stays. You know, she's a lot of years in. She tested for the first time probably 9 years ago or 10 years ago. So when she goes in an elevator, let's say, to the party, and then all the cast members file in, and then Lorne steps onto the elevator, and it's silent all the way down until the very end, and Lorne says something to the effect of, let's not tell Melissa what we really feel about her. She has the emotional tools in her toolbox to deal with it then, but maybe if she'd have gotten it early on.
Yeah.
She wouldn't have. You look at a Dave Koechner. Dave Koechner had 6 original characters.
Dude, you're not going to believe this. David Koechner! Come here, man. We knew that you guys had a relationship, with that, so man. We got him right here.
So, yeah, but he probably wasn't ready to navigate. Anyway, I'm sorry.
You know what I want to say about Melissa? I saw Melissa perform one time, and I was like about to record my album, remember? And I was like, can you come be on my album? Like, do a sketch? She was so damn talented. Like, at that moment, I'm like, please come do my album. And she did. Now she's you know, she was always awesome.
You might have been working with her. I was working when the OWN network, Oprah's network, first started up. I was writing and producing on a couple of projects there. And this guy came to me and was like, who do you know that does characters? And I was like, I know exactly who you need to talk to. And I introduced Melissa and him. And
David Kecker.
And they shot her and did something with her for the Oprah
Network.
When
you say shot her, it kind of scares me.
Bow and arrow, man. Bow and arrow.
Tape's gone. You can't say tape anymore.
After the murder of your father, I'm just scared of what you...
Just if you're in the car, it's all you got to worry about, man.
Anyway, I'm sorry. I'll get back to how I got into the business.
Yeah.
So... What happened was when I was a teenager, I went downstairs in the basement and I pried open an old file cabinet that was my dad's that was locked. And inside were all these musty albums, old albums. And what was shocking was, you know, Longmeadow was a really white town. There weren't any black people in the town. Yet every album except three was from a black artist, like Dinah Washington, Shirley Bassey, Louis Armstrong, Diana Ross, Nat King Cole. It was just endless. Mm-hmm. And there were three albums of white artists, and they were the Smothers Brothers, Crabs Walk Sideways and Lobsters Walk Straight, and the album where he's smashing the guitar over his head, Jonathan Winter's Comedy and Tragedy, and The Button-Down Mind of Bob Newhart.
Wow.
Wow.
And so I wanted to play these musical records and everything, but we didn't have a record player that worked, and we were very poor. So back then, I don't know if this is before your time or your audience's time, when you went to the supermarket, they gave you a green stamp for every dollar that you spent. They were called S&H green stamps. Mm-hmm. And you would paste them into these books that were valuable, and you would go to a redemption store and you could get something. So I got like 30 books, and I bought one of those fold-down record players. And I played the music.
Your mother's like, that was for a toaster oven! Barry, you got a record player.
You know my family very well. And so, yeah, so I started playing the music, and I didn't really get into it as much. And then I started playing the comedy, and the musical comedy was cool, but I wasn't musical. Jonathan Winters was more stream of consciousness like Robin Williams, and it was crazy. But Bob Newhart spoke to me because he created situations with people who weren't there, yet he didn't imitate the character. He used his own voice. Sort of. The only thing I can share with you what Bob Newhart's records were like, Ellen DeGeneres did one routine for 3 minutes at the end of her first Tonight Show called Conversations with God. You can look it up on YouTube. And that's the kind of comedy that Bob Newhart did. And I loved it. And I memorized this famous routine called The Driving Instructor, where he basically was a dangerous job, and he was in a car with a person who was trying to instruct. And I did it for my talent show. And
But he came from radio too, right? So do you think that's like a product of radio?
He came from radio and sketch. It's a really unbelievable story about the album. I'll tell it in like 30 seconds. So he gets the call from Warner Brothers saying, hey, Bob, we've heard you on these radio shows. We've seen you on TV doing sketches and stuff. We want you to record a comedy album. And in true Bob Newhart form, the way he talked, he was like, I've never done a stand-up comedy in my life in front of a live one. That's okay. Just find an audience and record it. So he...
Find an audience.
Yeah, so he did this gig in a club that maybe held 100, 200 people.
I have that album.
He recorded it, and... That was 1959, and that album was Warner Brother Records' first gold record.
Wow.
How crazy is that?
That's way crazy.
And so I do the routine in front of an assembly of 1,000 people, a talent show, and I've never been on stage before, and it fucking kills.
Newhart kills.
How old
huh?
were you when you're doing it?
I'm like 16, and I go on stage like, hey, I listened to this album. I love this album. It's an inspiration, Bob Newhart. And if you haven't heard it, I'd like to do for you my favorite routine from that album as an homage. And so, you know, when you're listening to the album, it's titters. It's like back then comedy, like you go to see like Joe Coy or George Lopez or Dane Cook or insert person here, one joke and people are jumping up and bumping chest. In that day, it was like titters. It was like, it was funny, but it was like not. And so I'm crushing like there's like 100 times the level of, and I'm saying maybe there's something in this for me. But I don't really do it again. And I go to college, and there's a blizzard. I remember this in 1978. I went to Boston.
Well, this is 78, dude. Of course. Yeah.
And so,
biggest blizzard in the history.
Was it?
Yeah. So I'm sitting in I'm standing in Kenmore Square looking out. If you've been to Boston, there's three streets that come off Kenmore Square. There's Commonwealth Avenue where BU and BC is. There's Beacon Street where Simmons College and Emmanuel is.
Sister
and
went.
Then there's Brookline Avenue where Fenway Park is. And I'm standing there, and this is just – you can't make this shit up. So there's no one, not a car, nothing, and I hear laughter. And I'm like, what's going on here? And I look at a brownstone bar that is actually still there today, ironically called Crossroads.
Oh my God.
And I open the door, and you can hear the laughter. But there's one of those rooms where there's a stairway right away going up. And when you walk up a stairway, as you know, you can't see anything. You just see stairs, and there's a banister. And like a little kid, I'm going where the banister is, and I'm looking through the shoes and the feet, and I see a guy on stage who looks like a young Larry from the Three Stooges.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got his foot on a chair, and he's strumming a guitar. I'll never forget this. And he says, "Rachel, my dear, wish you were here. Oh, how I loved her. Having sex with Rachel was amazing. It was like a concert. Frisbees would be flying around the room.
Who is
beach
it?
Balls
Stephen
would
Wright.
Be hitting me
oh,
in the
wow.
head. And every time she wanted more, she'd light a match." And so, and then he says,
"You saw that?" Which I've seen on television.
Yes. And so, and then he said, and then he just says, "Thanks."
Hey.
And he walks
Rachel,
through the.
Dear.
That's right.
Yeah.
And he walks through the crowd, walks down the stairs past me. And it's one of those things where you just, you know, you're like a take. You're looking back and forth. And what do I do? I run down the stairs to find him. Nowhere to be seen.
You're like, "Are you represented?"
I wasn't managing at the time, sadly. And I went back upstairs. I said, "Who was that?" They said, "That's Stephen Wright." So Stephen Wright was the first stand-up comedian I ever saw on stage.
Wow.
And I said, I want to do this. So I asked if there was an open mic.
Wait, I have to – I don't mean to interrupt, but I want to stop you there. The reason I am is because I love the movie Comedian. And not to make anyone sound bad, but when Orny was sort of like, "Well, who the fuck is Stephen Wright?" It's your scene. And you come in and you basically tell him, "Here's who the fuck Stephen Wright is, bro." You know, and I love now knowing, like, you're like, he's won an Academy Award. But now I love knowing that the reason Stephen Wright is in your life is because there was
oh
a blizzard.
Yeah,
and you
right.
heard a fucking laughter coming from a brownstone.
Which, by the way, because let's get
I got chills for that.
To get to the bottom of this whole thing.
Hold on a second.
Orny Adams! Come here, man.
Stephen Wright, get your ass.
Come in here.
But again, it plays into what I talked about
amazing.
Earlier with that tragedy, the fate.
Yeah.
Like, okay, why did I walk out in the middle of Kenmore Square then? Why didn't I just stay and go with my friends or do this? But I did that, and if I hadn't done that, you know, it would have inspired me. And so in the movie Comedian, again, you talk about fate. Like, I had no idea that Jerry was filming a documentary. I had no idea.
Really?
I was watching a client in the other room where this thing was. And I walk in and I see George Shapiro, who I love, who's Jerry's manager and producer of Seinfeld with the late Howard West. And Orny was there. And Orny just, you know, if you watch the documentary, he asked me the question, like, how do you feel, you know, I'm doing or whatever, or what advice do you have for me? And so when it got done, I was really thinking until I got a call from Jerry and his people, and he said, "Listen, we're going to send you a release." And I said, I don't sign releases unless I see exactly what's going in. Jerry, I have to see the release. I'm sorry, I have to see the footage. And they sent the footage, and at the end of the scene, after I say what I say, Orny says, "You know, that guy's a cocksucker." And I thought to myself, should I keep this in, or should I? And I realized that I should just keep it the way it is, and so I signed the thing. And it turned out, Jerry told me that, shockingly, that it was a pivotal scene, and I get so many comments.
I'll never forget that scene.
Mm-hmm.
I'll never forget. And here's the other thing, too, as you said, it's so great. You said you weren't a musical guy. So even though that was sort of a musical thing, had you heard music coming from that brownstone instead of laughter, you might not even walked in there.
That's true. And I want to say this about...
I mean, it was pretty cold in the biggest blizzard in the history of Massachusetts. So there's a good chance.
That's a chance. You might have
He could have heard screams and he would have went
go.
In.
But, you know, the thing about music and comedy, there's I remember I'd watch certain things on television like Jack Benny using the music as just a little setup and accelerator to the comedy, but it wasn't something that was necessary for the jokes. You know, we all know the people like, let's say, in the New York days, John Joseph might be one, Dennis Blair. Their comedy relied on the music, but Stephen Wright's comedy didn't rely on the music. It was just a novelty, and that's
it relied on one writing.
That song is burned in my head. My brothers and I listened to the I Have a Pony cassette until, I mean, we wore it out. We wore it out. We could not get enough of it.
Yeah, and it's just, and when I started, so I want to tell the story. So I went back to the open mic, and I just got done with a swimming championship, and I'd shaved my head.
I'm done. That's all the time we have. That's all the time. Howie subtly throws in the swimming championship.
Is that bad?
At BU?
Yeah.
You were a
no,
swimmer?
No, it's not bad at all. I love
or
it.
You were watching?
No, I was captain of the swim team.
Were you really?
Yeah.
So wait a minute. You got recruited to go to college to swim, and you got recruited to special needs camps? I mean, this guy's multi-talented.
I'm not going to say I was. I'll just say I wasn't recruited and have humility. So,
But you swam at BU?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We did really well.
Nice.
Really
Do you
well.
Hold any records that are still existing?
I held a lot of records with my teammates, but it's since been evaporated. Because people have gotten so much faster.
Yeah.
But I've shaved my body so many times. I've shaved my head. I mean, I can't even tell you how, you know, sandpaper over my body.
How tall are you?
I am 6'3", but right now I'm the letter O, so I'm probably about 5'11". So I go back, and I'm wearing these tight jeans and a shirt. I mean, I'm not, you know. What happens today in the world, we can talk about this later, and what happened then, I had no knowledge of really how the world worked or whatever it was. I was very sheltered. And so this guy is hosting. He's a huge guy. He's like much bigger than me and burly. They called him the taxi driver, Ross Bickford. And he goes on to introduce me. He does one of those things which I know has happened to you. He does something, I'm paraphrasing, but it's like, this next guy, I don't know him. Yeah, you know, he's not funny. He's gay, and he's hung like a buffalo. I'm just kidding. You know, he's not hung like a buffalo or something like that. Please welcome Barry. You know, just eviscerated me before my first stand-up set in a club. And I went on, and I just, you know, made some joke about sleeping with him, which worked. I don't know how that worked. And then I go on, and I do what I did at the auditorium. I set it up. I'd like to do this routine. This homage to Bob Newhart, and I do it, and again, fucking kills. And I'm like thinking to myself, what is going on here? And I just quietly walk down the stairs like Stephen Wright did, because I thought that's the way you do it.
Right, yeah.
And I just quietly walk out, and I feel these footsteps just, you know, chasing me, and I'm like, I'm at the door, and I look around, and it's Ross Bickford, the taxi driver. Mm-hmm. He says, kid, where'd you come from? I need you to come back every week. That was amazing. I just love what you did. Nobody gets that kind of response here. I'm like, well, thank you so much. I'll see you later. And he says, before you go, I want to give you some advice. I said, okay, what is it? He says, listen, when you're doing somebody else's material, just take the fucking bit. Don't mention their name beforehand.
Oh,
just steal it and make
taxi
it your own.
Driver, man.
Taxi driver.
Shit.
And I was like, okay, and then I literally ran back to my dorm and started writing original material and started doing stand-up, and that's how I started getting into the business.
Wow.
And I did stand-up in Boston for a long time.
Yeah.
And then you moved to Manhattan.
Hold on a second. If you're doing it then, that was the boom. That was like when Lenny's stealing buses and driving around, running
for
mayor. And
also, you got to be Stephen Wright as a kid. I mean, a young man, I would say, right?
The comedy scene there was incredible. And what happened was...
Dennis Leary, probably.
Yeah. And so I was doing...
What about Don Gavin, dude?
Don Gavin, Sweeney, DJ Hazard, Jack Gallagher... Bob Goldthwait, Paula Poundstone.
Wow, that's all Boston.
You'd lose your mind at Don Gavin.
Rosie O'Donnell, right before. And so what happened, It's crazy. So I started doing these sets around town. And another thing, you know, you meet these people. And like we talked about earlier before the show, like Chris DiStefano, like people are brilliant, but they're, you know, they're broken people, that, and that's what makes them brilliant. And I remember there was a place called the Ding Ho. It was a Chinese restaurant slash comedy club. And there was an open mic night that Lenny Clark hosted. And they would put these great comics on, every other comic, and an open mic micer would go on. I signed up. And so I'm going on after Sweeney and before Gavin, like these amazing spots. But you're going on with the greatest. If your audience can just think about this, imagine the greatest comedian that you ever saw in your life on an hour special that never made it but had the same level of ability to kill and material. That's what these guys were like. They were stuck in this town. They were like they were afraid to leave because people like Steve Sweeney, I know the audience and you guys aren't going to believe it. Steve Sweeney did three shows on a Friday night at a 400-seat room at Nick's Comedy Stop and would sell out every single show he did. And you think about that, that's like, you know, why leave? And that's why a lot of them couldn't leave.
I mean, that's before social media, before any of that shit, too. Yeah. Like, that's internet. Crazy impressive. Yeah, yeah, completely before the internet.
Well, when Stand Up Stood Out, you know, that documentary, that whole thing.
Yeah, that's a really good doc.
I love that. That's still see Lenny on that stage.
Fran Salami, that's the one documentary that I didn't do that I always think to myself. And back then, it's like I felt like, again, you can't promote yourself. You can't do anything. So I didn't do it, and I regret that because I love Fran. And I love those people. So I go to the Ding Ho. Again, I do a set, but now I do my original stand-up. And again, third time in a row, kills. But this is what I learn about life and the way comedy works. So I walk out silently again. Again, somebody's chasing after me. It's Lenny Clark. Now, for your audience, Lenny, the last thing he did, he was a series regular on Rescue Me, and he's a great actor.
I'm going to have to correct you. The last thing he did was the Gronk stand-up special with me on Showtime.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm just kidding. He's still doing it. You know what that guy did, Lenny Clark? And I mean, how old is Lenny now?
Probably 60, 63, 65.
I knew the assistant director on the shoot. You know, like we were friends and we got back to L.A. I'm like, that was fun in Boston, huh? He goes, yeah. He goes, how about Lenny Clark? And I go, I know, man. The guy's amazing. He goes, he still knows. He learned every single guy's name. I mean, he knew every single assistant makeup person. He knew their name. He was the sweetest,
that's
nicest
the way
guy
he
of
did
all time.
When he was in Boston, he used to have these index cards where he would be on the phone. And he would write down people's names and stuff and where they were from. And he, you know, it was in his house, which was called the Barracks. That's another story. But so I went on. So Lenny's chasing me down the street. He's like, Katsy, where did you come from? You got to come back here. You got to come back here. I had never seen. Come back here and open my show next week. I'm like, look, Lenny, I don't know how to tell you this, but I can't write 5 minutes of new material by next week. Again.
Yeah.
That I didn't know anything about comedy. Obviously,
I was the same way when I started. I thought every week was new.
So he looks at me. Right. He looks at me like, as they say, the stock line is the dog looks at the answering machine, and then he just unleashes three things in a row. He's like, "You dumb Jew bastard! You stupid fucking Hebe! You kike motherfucker! Just get back here next week, open my show, and do what you do." I'm like, okay, Lenny, thank you. I just came back the next week, and this is how you know how comedy is. I do the same exact thing. I do it the same way. Crickets. Nothing. Not one laugh. And I thought to myself, well, this comedy's not for me because I didn't have the mental toughness. So I stopped for a long time. Then I started doing it again. And this comedian named Chance Langton, a very famous Boston comedian who used to open up for Rodney, he had a club called Play It Again Sam's that he was running. And he said, I want you to be my doorman. I'll pay you $10 a night on Friday and Saturday. And you can go on at 5 minutes of two after all the four headliners and do 5 minutes.
1:55 a.m.
Yeah, 1:55 a.m. So I'm the dorm at, like, I'm going up on stage. I'm like, hey everybody, I know what you're thinking, the doorman, the show's gonna suck, and I would do my best, but I, you know, a lot of times I would bomb. But it's where I formed the relationships, you know, like you said, Lenny, and I formed the relationships with the comics. I treated them well. And when maybe he didn't want to pay them what they wanted to get paid, I tried to do my best to slip them some money and convince Chance to give them what. But they were making like $25. Stephen Wright was the highest paid comedian on the showcase sets at $45 a set.
Wow.
And the there would be some
much
people
more than that still, man. It's
25. Some people would make 35. And then, but so the owner of the club, the establishment, fired Chance and went to me. I'm a teenager at Boston University. And he says, listen, I like the way you are with everybody. I want you to take it over. And you just take the door. I'll get the bar and the food. And I looked at him, and because I wasn't a businessman at the time, I said, listen, are you sure you want to do that? I mean, you know, you can make a lot of money at the bar. He's like, listen, I don't want to deal with these fucking comedians, okay? I have my movie bar upstairs, and this is before DVD, so he had movies upstairs. He says, I'll take movies over comedians any day. I said, you sure you can do really well then? He says, no, I don't want to deal with fucking comedians. I love movies. You know why I love movies, Barry? I'm like, why do you love movies? I hope I can remember this. He said, they don't show up late.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They don't ask me for a raise. And they don't fucking talk back to me. You take the comedian. And
I'll
do
the movie.
This. And so I started and I built the comedy club around the people. And this is when I first knew that I had an eye for certain artists, because there were all these artists that in Boston that weren't really getting a lot of work, and I loved them. So I gave Bob Goldthwait the Wednesday show hosting. I gave Dennis Leary Thursday, Dana Gould Friday. Saturday, this is how crazy it is, in the mid-80s, I knew I needed to get somebody to, because this was a basement comedy club. Mm-hmm. And it certainly wasn't the number one comedy club, so I had to figure out what I needed to do to shake things up. So I went to Lenny Clark, and I said, I'll pay you $1,000 on Saturday night if you work my room. And he took that deal.
I would think so.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was paying him $333 a show in a comedy club that was like held 150 seats in the basement where I was getting $10 a head.
Damn.
And then on Sunday, I had Anthony Clark, who was on Yes Dear.
Oh, yeah,
and so many different
what
shows.
What was his Boston Common?
Boston
that
Common.
Was his first show.
Yeah,
his first.
Love that show.
That was with Tasha Smith.
That's right.
And that was on for 3 years.
Yep.
Yeah, so
I loved it.
And Anthony was just a naturally talented guy and just an amazing performer and one of the funniest guys you'll ever meet. And then you'd have all these people coming in, like Jonathan Katz, who created Dr. Katz, mm-hmm. and again, Paula Poundstone. And it was an amazing time. But I was a teenager, and I was booking, you know, adults. And it was challenging, but the club took off, and it was an amazing, amazing time. And then I started booking. I opened up a company, and I started booking one-nighters and comedy clubs all over New England. So I had like 50 gigs, a network of 50 gigs. It was crazy. But then what happens is, again, fate happens. And I got married when I was young, and my wife died after 8 months being married. She was 23.
Whoa, I'm sorry.
Man, I'm sorry.
And so that's a long time ago. Thank you. And so what happens is, you know, when something bad happens to somebody, everywhere you go, there's the negative positive thing. So you run into somebody, they hug you tight. They're like, Barry, okay, whatever you need, buddy. And so everywhere I went was the memory of that. But I had this huge operation, and I had the club, and it was all a cash business back then. It was crazy. And, you know, and I lived in this huge apartment that was $150 a month. That was like three bedrooms. It was craziness. So one day I just decided that I was going to make the transition, which is the hardest thing to do for anybody listening, is like, because you always think to yourself, well, if I do this, I'm not going to make as much money as I make here. You don't think like I'm going to do better, but I thought to myself, I can do this, and I figured, where can I go? And my mother always said, you know, You go to New York, Barry. If you can make it there, I think it was from a Sinatra song she was listening to, you can make it anywhere. And she used to say, like, you know, if you can get there. And so I got in my car, my 67 Camaro.
T-tops?
No, it was the first one. It was the three-speed on the... And
three
I bought
on
it for,
the tree?
Bought it for $200 so when I was a kid. And I drove to New York. I got off the 79th Street Boat Basin exit and drove. Then there was a restaurant bar. And back then, you know, you go to the bar. There's a payphone at the bar. Mm-hmm. There's a yellow pages there. And I just looked up real estate, and I called and gave them the number of the payphone. And the first person that called back, he said, I have an apartment on 82nd Street by Central Park. It's a fourth-floor studio, 935, 940, whatever it was. I said, I went in, I saw it, I took it, and I was in New York now. But I had no idea what I was going
right,
to do.
Yeah.
So then,
got a car in New York, too.
So then, coincidentally, Eddie Brill calls me. Eddie Brill used to be the booker of the Letterman show. And Eddie says, you know, Barry, I have this club, the Paper Moon, but I want to go to L.A., and it's not really doing that well. You can talk to the owners, see if they'll let you do it. I go down there, and I talk to the owners, and Rick Messina, who manages Tim Allen and Drew Carey, but back then had a network with this guy Tony Camacho, like I did in Boston, had taken over this room, and I'm like, ah, oh, damn it. So I called Rick Messina, and I said, listen, if you ever – don't want to do this anymore. I'd love to do this club. And 6 weeks later, I called him back, and he said, you know, it's not doing anything. You can have it. Just give me the sound system back. And I talked to the owners, and I said, listen, I want to make this into the Boston Comedy Club. And they looked at me like, this is New York.
Right.
I said, I think we can do something here. And they let me do anything I wanted. It was unbelievable. They didn't even know me.
Yeah.
And I changed it, put marquees on, did everything, and the first comedian on stage, who was my first client, management client ever, helped me run the wires, do the lights before the show started, was Louis C.K.
Wow. That's awesome, man. That's crazy. I love that you were down and dirty on it, too. You know, like Tim Robbins has a theater company in Culver City.
The Actors Gang.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I love that place. And my wife and I had a subscription for a while. And, Ben Kane, he was part of that theater company. And I was like, how involved is Tim Robbins? He goes, you see that floor you're standing on? I'm like, yeah. He goes, he laid that floor. So I love that you were, like, not just booking it, but you were, like, ground up.
It was ground up. And we just – it
Did
was,
you eventually own it?
I never owned the physical space, but I owned the name, the number, and I had it as long as I wanted it. And the time came when I decided to leave, I gave it back to the club. And but then it only lasted a year after that. So and I had it for, I think, 17 or 20 years.
And, damn, and it went away after 1 year of you leaving.
Yeah, I mean, it's again, it's
commitment.
Relationships. Yeah. The reason why the Comedy Cellar in New York is so special, whether you like the people, you don't like them, Esty, she it seems like she's always there, and she cares. Almost like when they open up a place in Vegas, you almost say to yourself inside, oh no, don't do that. Just stay with this thing, because this is what makes this so special. Don't open up a chain of things, because that club in New York is and my club was right around the corner, and the owner was Manny Dwarman, who since passed away. And I was like competing with him. I came in and he was right around the corner, and I took I took a lot of business in the beginning, way, because I would identify the comedians who I thought were extraordinary who weren't working in these places. So I had, Chappelle working there, Tracy Morgan, Brewer, Daryl Hammond, Jeff Ross, just Wanda Sykes, all these people before they ever worked at the Comedy Cellar.
Wow.
And so, and then I eventually would just keep going over there, even though he would ban me and not want me there. Because I really loved his club. I know it sounds crazy, I loved his club more than my club, even though my club became such a hangout and it was crazy, and the roast we had of myself for different annual things. And I just felt like there was something really special happening there, and I loved it, and I loved Esty, and I loved Manny, and I couldn't accept the fact that they didn't like me, and I just kept coming back until I was at that famous table almost every night just hanging out with them, and I love being with them. I love what they built, and I respect them tremendously.
You started to tell a Tracy Morgan story, and then we were like, hang on, let's introduce you, and now you said his name. I wanted to – so you went – it was him, four children, a girlfriend. You remember the street. Was this – did you help him get on Martin when he would open the coat when he had, like, rotisserie chickens?
That was Hustle Man.
Hustle Man, that's yeah. Right.
No, I wasn't involved with him, with Martin. He had a manager at the time at the Uptown Comedy Club, and I remember – like it was yesterday, because I had this office at 57th and Broadway. And because my mom always told me, if you're going to open an office, open it at 57th and Broadway.
She did.
Or Sentinel in Venice. And so so I chose 57th and Broadway.
That's a great, great choice.
Good choice. Good East Coast choice.
I love hearing you guys laugh. It's like heroin. It's beautiful. And so I'm there in my office one day, and I always went to the Uptown Comedy Club in Harlem. I loved it up there. And I was, you know, I was the only white person in that club ever. Mm-hmm. But I felt comfortable. I felt I loved it. I loved hanging out with everybody. There were great comics like the late Monteria Ivy. There was this guy Maceo who was amazing. There was just Arsenault and Mitchell. There were Talent, a guy named Talent.
Talent's the Round.
Just an
what a dope name, huh?
Talent's incredible, the Round. One of the most incredible performers you could ever imagine. And Tracy, and he was just such a great physical comic. I never wanted to give up on him, and I was very persistent, even though I wasn't persistent with him when he had a manager, but he would come to me and say, you know, I love what you're doing, but I'm with this manager. I said, listen, you know, if it ever happens, it happens. So one day there's a knock on the door, and he nobody doesn't even wait to come. He just walks into my office, and I'll never forget this. He's wearing, like, dirty cargo shorts.
I need to start wearing shorts more to some important shit, it sounds
right.
Like.
Kidding, right?
I would never do that.
He's got one of those t-shirts, white t-shirts, that isn't white anymore. You know what I'm talking about? Totally. It's not even a form of white. It wouldn't even be a paint color. It's so off-white. And there's you know, moth holes in it, and his shoes are all dirty. It looks like he was working on his car. He's got the hair that, what did Imus say that got him in trouble?
Nappy.
Yeah. So Tracy would say he's got this, like, it's all over the place. And he's got a beanie, a multicolored beanie on his head. He looks like
the
Oscar.
Tweedledee, Tweedledum one he would wear on the show? Yeah, that?
With the thing coming up with the propeller.
Yeah, that's what he would wear. That was Hustle Man.
Yeah. So he comes in like that, but the hair is out there. He looks like Oscar Gamble with the Yankee helmet.
That's how he came to a meeting with Barry. Well, I don't know if it was a meeting.
Well, I didn't know what it was.
For Tracy it was. For Barry it was.
Yeah, exactly.
And he said...
It was an intrusion.
Yeah, that's exactly what that was. An interruption.
And he said, yo, B, I'm living in the projects. I'm in trouble. I need your help. Could you represent me? I know I can do great things. And I agreed to work with him. And first thing I did was I was a great editor. And I took his Hustle Man scenes and little pieces of stand-up. And I sent it to the different studios and networks in L.A. because I was going back and forth. And at the WB, they loved what he did. And I set up a meeting with him. And he got a $60,000 holding deal from January 1st to the end of pilot season in May. And with that money, he was able to take his family out of Loring Avenue, I'm getting emotional, and go to a high-rise another part of New York, overlooking the water. And it was just a great moment. And then I decided that I felt like he could get Saturday Night Live. And so I started putting stuff together and cutting things and sending them to Lorne.
Did you already have a relationship with Lorne?
Yes, from Jay Moore. So from the first mm-hmm. guy I had on. And so, but I hadn't had anybody else on, but now he was listening to me, and Marcy was listening more to me, and they were coming to showcases. And so I get him a test for SNL. He couldn't believe it. you know, I said, listen, you're going to do in a test. And I was excited as a manager because I had 7 people out of 16 testing at the comic strip.
Wow.
7 wow. out of 16. And so I was thinking to myself, that's when moments when you know that something's happening in your profession and you're doing something right. You know, something luckily is happening. So he looks at me in fear when I tell him, and he says, Barry, you'll be, I can't do this. I said, why can't you do this? He said, I've never worked in a white comedy club in my entire life. And I said, don't worry about it. We got like a little less than a week. We'll work on it. I had him come up to my office. There was an empty office next to mine. And we'd go over the set over and over again like a drill sergeant. And he would be in front of me with no audience going over and over and over again. Then we went around to some of the white comedy clubs or the mainstream comedy clubs. And 48 hours before the test, I get a call from Lorne and Marcy Klein. Lauren really didn't speak. It was Marcy. And she said, Barry, we appreciate everything you do. Look, you got 7 people testing. It's incredible. We never had anything like this. But there's 16 people on the show. And Lauren feels it's too many people. And he wants to take one of the people off the show. And we've looked at the lineup. We looked at everybody. And unfortunately, one of your artists, we feel, has the least chance of getting the show. I said, you can't do that, Marcy. You can't do that. She said, well, I'm sorry, Barry, but we got to do it. And it's Tracy Morgan. I said, Marcy, you can't do this. I've been working with him for, he's so prepared. He's ready. I guarantee you he's going to exceed all your expectations. Please. She's like, I'm sorry, Barry. And she hung up. And so back then, again, there's no email. There's nothing. You either messenger something, you call, or you FedEx, or you fax. And that's what I did. You know, that day I messengered 3 notes. I was typing them out on one of those typewriters that has the ball and you put the white out in where you're like making mistakes.
I got one in the other room.
I'm sure you do. And so I was messengering. I was calling every hour. Nothing. No response. But I didn't want to tell Tracy. I still believed that I could. And it's like 4 o'clock of the day of the show. And I'm calling like literally like every 10 minutes. And all of a sudden the phone picks up. And I'm like, Marcy? She's like, who the fuck do you think you are? This is Saturday fucking Night Live. You don't fucking call and messenger and hound me. This is a fucking professional organization here. Who the fuck do you think you are? I'm like, Marcy, I just feel like...
And you staying just calm like this calm. Right here.
And Marcy, I just feel... I always stay calm. I never lose my temper. And so, except with probably my dog. And so she says, I said, please, you know, you got to listen to me. She's like, shut the fuck up. I'm like, Marcy, please, let me just make my argument of why Tracy... Shut up. I'm like, please, he really should do this. He's prepared. He's shut up. The fuck up. and I shut up and I'm like, what is it, Marcy? She says, he's on the show. Now burn my fucking phone number. She hangs up on me.
Amazing.
So again, persistence and hopefully relationships. And I pray that, she, you know, I didn't worry about her being mad at me because I knew he was going to blow them away.
I mean, not only did he blow them away, he's ended up working for NBC for decades.
And Lorne. Yeah. And so he does the test and he gets the show. And
he got it. And
he's the only person from that lineup that got Saturday Night
Live. Did you ever tell him that they had pulled him or that you went through all this? I mean, before the showcase.
After he signed the contract for SNL, I told him, and he told me that if I'd have told him back then, he never would have done the show.
Yeah.
So that's like, these are the stories that
that's
you
so
can't
great,
believe.
I first met Tracy and worked with him in Irvine. It was actually, it was years ago. It was, I opened Orny Featured and Tracy Headline. And this was just when he had left SNL coming here and Lorne was producing his sitcom. The one that didn't last long.
The one with
long.
The kid.
That's right.
And he kept telling me, like, you know, Lorne Michaels is Obi-Wan Kenobi. Like, I just loved listening to the advice. And I was so used to doing stand-up on small stages in L.A. that when I got to a big stage, I sort of stayed in one spot. And Tracy was like, listen, I'm going to tell you something that Martin Lawrence told me that Eddie Murphy told him. And I'm just like, oh, my God. Like, I'm getting this. And he's like, the people over there paid for tickets and the people all the way over there paid for tickets. And when you're on a big stage, you walk over there and you talk to those people and you talk to those people. And that was the first time I also was able to, like, reset in between things. So when you're, as long as you're walking and something's happening, there's some sort of movement and you can continue to go and everything. And that was the first time I felt free physically on stage to get out of that box, so to speak. And that was Tracy Morgan.
And you look at him and you look at, like I said, the navigation. Now, technically speaking, based on everything he'd been through, you know, would you think that he had the tools in his toolbox at SNL to make it through that first year where he didn't even get on, hardly? Dave Koechner's getting on. He's got six characters. He's fired. And luckily, he's had a tremendous career after that, and that all worked out for him. But Tracy kept going and kept working through it. And I think if Tracy were sitting here, he would say, look, I certainly didn't make the impact on SNL that Eddie Murphy made or Kristen Wiig, but I've maintained that when I get on, people love me. I'm huggable and lovable. They laugh a little bit. Sometimes they laugh a lot. And I've created great relationships with NBC and Lorne where I keep going.
Do you remember what characters he did? Did he do Brian Fellow when he went in for the audition? And, like, do you remember what he did?
He didn't do any of the characters that he did on the show in this audition. He just had these different things that he was doing at the Uptown, which never really got on the air, to be honest with you. And I think after the first or second year when those things didn't get on the air, then he created new characters with the writers.
That's amazing.
So what would you say? I mean, you've worked with, obviously, the top. Who's been the craziest and why? Like, what's the craziest story you think you have of anyone out there where you're like, holy shit?
Well, I think, you know.
And also, I want to know, because you say you just stay just like this through all of it. And I'm just curious how far you've been.
I do. And you can talk to Jay Moore, who I represented for 25 years, and he'll tell you that he never saw me lose my temper.
I want to give you some props, too, real quick, because I'm also friends with Charlie Grenzer, who I met. So Charlie was working with Jay, which is how Tom met Jay and
Tom Segura.
Right. And ultimately, Charlie, I met Charlie through Tom because I met Tom through comedy. But when Charlie had left for North Carolina, I just remembered this. He spoke so highly of you because you were the only one that told him. You gave him something, I believe, a gift. And he spoke so highly and you told him. I think you encouraged it and said, if you're ready to come back, you come back and all that. You didn't, you know, like, once you're gone thing. And but I don't think anybody else even said anything to him. And I'll never forget he said that you did that. So kudos to you for that, because that's very kind.
Well, that means a lot. You know, so it's like these, you talk about the stories. There's just so many stories. I mean, one that, you know, Chappelle, working with Chappelle for 8 or 9 years, you know, when you get to work with a genius, you know, it's like, it's just, he was just, and I can't even explain the kind of artist he was. He was just so affable, and still to this day, it's like you feel like it's the same kind of thing. It's just at a different level. And for somebody to do things their own way, like, we think about, like, what's the most money that you guys have ever turned down? I mean, this is a guy who turned down $50 million.
Yeah.
Okay, $50 million. I don't know anybody who's turned down, you know, $50,000 or $100,000 or whatever it is. Well, maybe I do. But the point being is that what kind of belief do you have in yourself as an artist to say to yourself, you know, I'm going to make that money back. And yeah, granted, it was 11 or 12 years later, but he got the $60 million deal from Netflix.
Yep, he made it back plus.
And he did it his own way. He didn't have to do television shows or commercials or films. He put up shows whenever he wanted to put them up. And one of the things about being a manager when you don't work with artists anymore is you pray that you can have a great relationship with them still. I don't want to hold a grudge. I know the work I did. You know, I know, you know, if Chappelle were sitting here, he wouldn't say, "Oh, that Barry Katz, what a shitty manager." Mm-hmm. I mean, he did $400 million movies. He did 7 pilots in 8 years. One of the stories, and it's not like the holy shit moment kind of story, but I think it just shows Dave's character and what he's like and what he was like back then. We did our 7th pilot for Disney in 8 years. And
not all with Disney, but this was...
They were all with Disney.
Oh, really?
All with Disney.
Is this before Robin Hood?
No, this was, you know, Robin Hood, Men in Bad Men in Tights. Was I just found the Achu, what do you call it, director's chair thing, oh, a box. I got to give that to him. So, you know, he'd done some of the movies throughout, and things were getting bigger and better for him. And I remember we went up to the office of Dean Valentine, who was the president, and we, you know, we're going to hear whether we were going to move forward or not. He wanted to do it personally. And he told us that the show wasn't going to move forward. And that was like the longest walk. If you've ever been in the Team Disney building, it's this building that's like a mausoleum, and there's these tiles, really expensive tiles. And when you walk, you can hear yourself walking. Even if you're wearing, you know, like ballet slippers, you could hear yourself walking. And it's a long hallway. And I'm walking. I don't, at this point, you know, normally I always have something to say. I've got nothing to say. I've got nothing. I'm just walking down the hallway because I have had this artist that I love and I believe in and I revere. This is the 7th pilot he's done, and with great people too, great showrunners that he had. And it failed. And so we're walking out. He's not saying a word. I'm not saying a word. And you just hear the footsteps. And we get outside. And if you're familiar with the Team Disney building, let me paint the picture for your audience. It's a A-frame kind of concrete building, and up at the top they have the 7 dwarfs like sort of holding up the building. Yeah,
right next to the sorcerer's cap.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so we get outside, and again, for one of the first times in my life, I'm speechless. I have nothing to say, and I'm looking at Dave, and he does, you know, this thing where he, you know, reaches into his jacket, pulls out a pack of cigarettes, and he just does that thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, smash him with his hand, and he undoes the plastic. No one's talking. Pulls out a cigarette, taps it, puts it in his mouth, lights it, takes a big puff, blows it out. And he looks at me and he says, "Barry, man." I'm like, "Yeah, Dave." And he looks up at the 7 dwarfs holding up the building, and he takes another puff. Fucked by the mouse again.
Oh, man.
That's amazing.
So that's an insight into the character of how he was.
Yeah.
And how he still is today. Like, he invited me to so many shows. He invited me and my son to Radio City Music Hall. And again, you know, all you want is the relationships, all you want. And, you know, and it's a metaphor for everybody listening. Like you mentioned that Charlie Gerenzer, I can't pronounce his last name ever. But, you know, you want to hear those things where you did something and people remember. You don't want to be the guy who says, "Oh, that's the guy who was the asshole to me."
Yeah.
You want to be known as the person who did that, because it always will hopefully come back to you. And even if it doesn't come back to you, at least it's out in the way it is there. And so when he invited me to the show at Radio City Music Hall, and he got the tickets for me and one of my sons, you don't know. I still don't know. You know, I still, like everybody else, I still might look in the mirror and say, how's it going to be when I see him? Because even though I see him sometimes, and it's great, And so I get there, and then somebody comes out and gets us and say, "Come back here in this line here." And I'm in this long line. I'm thinking, my son in this line. And then Jeff Wills, who's like the head of Live Nation, comes over and says, "Dave wants you to come in." And you come in early, and there's nobody in this huge area dressing room. And then people start filing in, and there's like 200 people inside there. And I'm thinking to my son, we're never going to say hello to him. It's not going to happen. And he finally walks in. And my son says, you know, go up to him. You should go up to him right now and say hello to him. And I said, no, Zion, I'm just going to wait here. He said, no, Dad, you're persistent. You always persist. And you, no, you'll see what happened. If it's meant to be, it's meant to be. And he walks in. He talks to one person, sees me, makes a beeline to me, and spends like 30 minutes with me and my son while all these people are waiting, and makes such an impact on my son and just inspires him, like, you know, and that's the kind of person that Dave is. He's just, he'll do anything for anybody. He's the sweetest, most unbelievable person. And again, a genius. And there's no surprise why he's doing what he's doing. And yeah, we all know geniuses in the building, and in the building, I say, because you yell out to people here.
But the back room.
But the point is, as comics, you guys, it's an unspoken thing. You don't, when you're doing comedy, no comedian likes to talk about who the geniuses are, because you want to be the best comedian in the world. You want to be as good as anybody. Mm-hmm. And then you see Jim Jeffries do a gun control bit, or you see him imitating Oscar Petorek with no legs killing his model girlfriend, and he's dragging himself across the stage, and you're like, okay, I can't do that. I can't make that work. Or you watch Cat Williams's earlier. I always talk about these things because
you're talking about two huge Cat Williams.
Because if you watch Cat, if you're a comedy fan listening, this is one thing that I think is important to understand. So if you watch Cat Williams' last special from Jacksonville, what you're going to see is a guy talking about Jacksonville probably for 15 or 20 minutes. Then he's going to talk about his dick for 15 minutes at the end. And even though you're laughing as an audience viewer, those in comedy might say, oh, God, you know, what's he doing? Why is he doing that? And I'll tell you why he's doing it. Because he can.
Thank you.
Because he's paid his dues. He's done his three fucking brilliant specials. And he just wants to do something for him. It's like when I was at Radio City Music Hall with Chappelle. He came out and he says, I'm sorry, everybody. I'm not going to do what I was going to do because Charlottesville just happened and I have to talk about it. He does 30 minutes on Charlottesville and people are losing their mind. Nothing he's ever done before that night. Not one word. 30 minutes. And he ends this piece on this huge applause. Like it's a 6,000 seater and he's sold out 20 shows at this place. And then he pauses again, similarly to how he did outside the Disney building. And he's by the stool, and he takes a drink of water, and he does this joke that he did in the special. And again, I'm paraphrasing. He says, you know, I'm getting older, I'm 44. You know, guys, when you're alone in your bedroom, and the door is closed, and you start touching yourself, and halfway through you just say, fuck it, I'm too tired, I'm going to bed. So he does that joke, kills. Then he does 30 minutes again of fucking brilliant stuff. And I have the kind of relationship with these people. I like to talk about these things. So backstage, after he talked to my son, I just said, I have to ask you something, Dave. I said, everything you did was incredibly brilliant. And then you did that one joke in the middle that you did, and it was fantastic, and it got huge laughs. But you know that's the only joke in the set that anyone could do. Mm-hmm. And he just looked at me again and again, similar to the thing, took the puff out of the cigarette and said, Barry, man, sometimes I just like to do things for me.
That's it.
Yeah.
And I said, good for you. You deserve that. And I've had those moments, like when Chris Rock shot that special, that I think it was his fourth or third special, and he opened up with like 10 minutes of Michael Jackson material, and I was there, and I was in the dressing room afterwards, and he came out, and he came right up to me and said, what do you think? And he said, be honest, Barry, you're always honest. I said, I fucking loved it. I'm just trying to understand why you did 10 minutes of Michael Jackson material up front. And he said, listen, Barry, you know, I've earned it. I've paid my dues. I've done these specials. And no one's going to do Michael Jackson material like I do. I'm going to do the best Michael Jackson material. And if I want to do it, I'm going to fucking do it.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's similar to something that Jay Moore often says when somebody talks to him about something. He says, how many jokes did you write today?
Yeah.
And so these people, they've earned that right. But when you're comedians out there and you're sitting here, it's hard to talk about people who are geniuses because we have the only profession that truly, there's so few geniuses in comedy that are working today. It's like if you look at, like, say, music, I mean, even if you have arguments with each other, you're going to name 20 people who are geniuses.
Yeah.
And you could be arguing over them and still say, I got to have it. But when you talk about comedy, like, how many people are really doing the right thing and really can do the right thing? And that's why when I see a lot of comics working, it shocks me because today everybody can see what the right thing is to do. You have every frame of every set that you can watch, yet people are still doing, you know, what part of the chicken does the McNugget come from? Or, you know, Gilligan's Island, hey, they could make a blender out of two bamboo poles, but they can't fix a hole in a boat this big. And you think to yourself, and maybe it's because they see a Cat Williams doing what he loves and not caring on that fourth special or whatever it is. And they think, well, if he's doing it, he's a genius. I can do that. But to me, like, you have to start off as a comic doing the right thing. If your lane is dirty, then ride the lane. If you're Colin Kane, ride the lane. That's what you do. You're like one of three people who do over-the-top blue material, insult humor. If that's what you know how to do and you've been doing for 10 years, then ride the lane. You know you're not going to get on television unless you get a special, and that's it. It's like Dice when he first, you know, he's not going to get on regular television. But if you're a comic, I forget how he pronounced his last name now, Sam Morril, let's say, from New York. Is it Morril?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, if you watch his Conan set, and I know I'm a savant when it comes to comedy, if you just watch his Conan set, even though he's a guy who plants his feet and is in front of the mic and isn't necessarily giving you like the Cat Williams thing where he's wiping the sweat off mm-hmm. his face, you know, the jokes are so, you know, they're constructed well. There's an originality about them. You can see that he's on the right path. Do people today really want to see a guy who's just stands there and doesn't give, you know, like walk the stage? I don't know if they, you know, it goes in cycles the way comedy works. And a lot of people like that and a lot of people don't. I tend to gravitate to even Stephen Wright will walk the stage and he's as slow as there is. But to me, the content,
that's the thing.
The content is what defines everybody, and you guys as comedians, you know this. You know, if I were to tell you, I like to say this to comics, so if I were to say to you, okay, as I like to say, all your material is drowning in the ocean, and you have these index cards, you know, that you've written down, okay, hair bit, 3 minutes and 36 seconds, you know, my child, you know, at home, 2 minutes and 16 seconds. The DMV, 3 minutes, and you have all these bits, and you pretend they're all drowning in the ocean, but you just put them up like you have a big wall here. Imagine you put every single piece of comedy that you've done, and you put it on the wall. And imagine, if you will, that you had George Carlin, Richard Pryor, yes, Bill Cosby, and insert other name here, who's ever on your Mount Rushmore of comedy. Mm-hmm. And imagine if they're watching the greatest performance of your life doing that set. Like, let's say that one bit that you've done where you can remember, God, when I did that at the University of New Hampshire, it never got as big a response as that.
yeah.
So imagine that you have them for an entire day. And they can watch these bits one by one, and they're commenting on them, and they're telling you, and they're like, you know, it's like you look at somebody like Brad Williams, let's say, and they might say, hey, listen, Brad, and something I told him as well, listen, you know, that thing where you do the lap dance at the end, you know, I don't think you should do that. And he'd be like, what are you talking about? That gets a standing ovation. That's my closer. But, you know, Richard Pryor would say, if there was one of your bits that you close with or something that's big, at least, like, listen, that's just, you know, that's just you're fucking somebody in that bit. That bit, you're talking about your cock. This bit, you're talking about menstruation. Just get rid of it. Just do this. And then if you imagine what their opinions would be, and then you start thinking about what Chris Rock would say, what Chappelle would say, which bits of yours are the ones that stand the test of time. And then you start putting numbers for them and ordering them. Okay, that's my best bit. That's my second best bit. And that's my 100th best bit. And then here's the stuff that even though it kills and it gets, you know, a standing ovation, that's not going to garner me any respect. Mm-hmm. And if all comics could figure out a way to do that, I mean, they'd really advance much quicker. And that's why a lot of comics take 10 years to get to where they need to go, is because it's so much trial and error, and they don't always observe the people around them. And you gotta, you know, I always say, as boring as it is, you know, study greatness, imitate greatness, and become great. I'm not saying imitate it like steal it.
Like your Bob Newhart said.
Yeah. but what I'm saying is that as a comic, you have to see what's out there. You have to see why things are happening. Why is Cedric the Entertainer on television again and again and again?
With
and again?
A name that is, I bet you some manager out there probably would have said, that's going to be tough to overcome, yeah, that name.
But the reason why he's on television over and over and over again is because he's obviously doing something right.
100%.
Why is Cat Williams? I just was with Cat Williams at the Microsoft Theater. Invited me to the show. Again, another situation backstage. It's like royalty, and I get asked back with him, and you're sitting across from somebody. Why is he selling out 7,000 seats? Why is that? Why is another guy not selling out 7,000 seats? Because he's doing something that the world loves, and he's giving all the effort in the world. And for the most part, what you do a year ago is what affects you a year later. So what you guys are doing now is going to affect you 6 months and a year from now. So this special in Jacksonville, maybe the next time he goes out on tour, maybe they'll be like, well, you know, I thought he was great, but I really didn't. I wish he hadn't done that kind of material, and maybe it might be less. But the fact is, this is a guy who doesn't show up at a lot of gigs. This, yeah, is a guy that was in I think it was the Mohegan Sun or somewhere in Massachusetts, like a 10,000 seat venue. He canceled the night of, then they booked him 3 weeks later. He canceled again. Yet people keep coming.
They do.
They keep coming out.
I was in Ontario when he did. He was an hour and a half, 2 hours late. The hotel, you know where the hotel's, like, you can see it. It's right there. Like, why would he come? Then they said, and I want to go back to that Jacksonville thing, too, because it's funny you brought that up. They said he had some ladies come out with him. They laid a carpet out on the stage and put some cattle skulls out and hung stuff from the – all. He's already an hour and a half late. Already before they do all this to set up his show, and he came out and he said they waited and they were patient and they loved it. Like, they loved the dude.
Yeah, and you'll talk about that in a second. But, like, I remember the last time I saw the Rolling Stones was a smaller venue in Vegas, and it was supposed to start at 8 and they came on at 10:30. You know, I don't care. I don't care. I'm there to see the Rolling Stones.
Right, yeah.
And so with Cat Williams and with Chappelle, these are people who are bigger than life. You know, Chris Rock is somebody who's been creating since, I mean, the guy did CB4.
Right.
I mean, the guy knew what it was like to create, you know, great original content long ago and has never stopped. And that's what I believe it is in comedy, and that's why there's so few geniuses. Yeah, there's people who sell out many, many shows, but that's for different reasons. Sometimes they have a different lane. Sometimes, mm-hmm, they're, you know, there's a different group of people that come for them.
And now with the internet, you can reach, everyone can have their, like, tiny little lane and reach a giant population,
right,
because they can see them, find them.
You look at Angela Johnson. She did the, mm-hmm, nail salon, yep, bit. you know, I think to myself, Buddy Hackett didn't have any social media when he did the Chinese waiter bit, which was his famous bit, which he probably couldn't do today.
You, nope. That's out today.
And so, and for her, she did her nail salon bit, which she probably, you know, if it came out today.
That'd be interesting if it was today, if that would get tough.
But the fact is that people loved it. Bo Burnham is in his bedroom. He's 17. He's doing songs on his guitar. Like most of the audience listening, and if Bo were sitting here, I don't think he'd be upset to say that most people who've been around in comedy a long time didn't understand what was happening, but they didn't understand what's happening because it wasn't their audience.
Sure.
It was his audience. And so he did this comedy, and he got an hour special before he was even a comedian.
Yeah. Had never set foot on stage.
Never done anything like that. And if you've ever been around Bo, he's a guy who's like, he's an incredibly powerful presence, but he's a little quiet and uncomfortable sort of in his own skin, at least at the time. And now, you know, he's 27, and you think to yourself, well, he's a guy who does songs and whatever. And then he writes, produces, and directs
Eighth Grade,
mm-hmm. which is getting critical acclaim.
It's amazing.
And this is what we have to look at.
He directed Chris Rock's last special.
Yeah.
Yeah, Tambourine.
And so this is what blows me away, which I love about our business, but so many artists don't understand, is that you have a lot of cylinders in your engine, but so many comedians only choose to use one or two.
Yeah.
And would you, if I were to tell you 5 years ago, yeah, Bo Burnham, I'm going to have him, he's going to be directing Chris Rock's special, you'd laugh me out of this podcast. If you were to say 5 years ago, you know, Jordan Peele, he's going to write a horror movie.
Right.
It's going to be nominated for an Academy Award and he's going to do that. You'd be like, what are you, fucking crazy? Comedians they have great minds and they can go all over. They can do radio, they can do books, they can write films that are drama, they can write films that are comedy, TV that's comedy, TV that's drama. They can create game shows, create reality shows, they can do radio, podcasts, live performances, but they don't. They don't. And they think like, oh, well, I'll just write a script. Well, that last script didn't go anywhere. I mean, you know, I passed it around. Nobody liked it. Yeah, that was five fucking years ago. You know, why aren't you writing a script every year? I had a conversation with a client who shall remain nameless, who's been doing it probably 30 years, very successfully, really successfully, and asked me, like, I don't understand. Like, everybody else is getting shit, and, you know, I've done a lot of series. I've done a lot of movies. How come I'm not getting anything? I said, could you tell me how many things you've written in 30 years? Tell me how many sitcoms you've written and tell me how many movies you've written. And there was a pause. He said, zero. I said, that's right, because you choose to work for the fucking man instead of being the fucking man. And everybody who makes it and everybody who we respect in the business creates their own shit and gets it out there, and that's why Chris Rock is who he is. That's why Chappelle is who he is. That's why Neil Brennan is doing what he's doing. That's why Jim Jeffries, I mean, legit, that show was fucking amazing, a dark show with heart. Yeah. But you can point to anybody. You know, Amy Schumer created her own vehicles. It's like Aziz Ansari, Master of None. Just, it's, you know, this is what you have to do, but people don't understand. They just think, oh, well, let me wait for the opportunity. And you guys know many, many great comedians who I'm not going to single out here, but great comedians working at the Comedy Store and other places that you watch them and you're like, holy shit, this guy's really original. He's done a lot of television. He's done a lot of film. Why isn't he bigger? And you look and you realize, well, because he's never created anything for himself. He's waiting for the role. And that can work. It worked for Aziz Ansari. He's doing late night spots at 1:30 at the Cellar. He auditions for Parks and Recreation. He's on television for 7 years. It can work. It can work. But it doesn't always. Yes, De Niro and Pacino and Meryl Streep, they don't write their own shit. It worked for them. But
they're actors.
But in our profession, you have to create. You have to keep creating and putting stuff out there. It's scary. You know, you think Garfunkel and Oates weren't scared. You know, they had their own careers. They might have said they were going well or they weren't going well, or but they were building, and they do something on their own, and they create some original musical comedy, and 10 million views for the first video. It's insane.
Yeah. And you never know what's going to resonate with people for something to take off like that, you know, unless you put it out there.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Abso-fucking-lutely, dude.
Well, Barry, we are at that time. We got to wrap this up here. Thank you.
Thanks
this
so
has been
much,
awesome.
Man.
This has been fucking awesome to sit here and talk this with you. And thank you for sharing the stories. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for your time. One more time, please promote your podcast, anything you'd like.
Sure. It's just industry standard podcast. You can get it on any place, Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whatever. And again, it's free. Just subscribe. And I can guarantee you, if you can get past the sound of my voice, it will change your life forever. I can guarantee you that. It's the stories and the advice that these people give.
Especially with the guests you're getting. It's amazing.
It's incredible. I mean, it's just, you know, when you can have the president of Netflix telling you how to make it,
yeah,
or Kevin Hart or David Copperfield telling you how to do it. I mean, I know it's the end of the show, but David Copperfield, 61 years old, does 680 shows a year.
Holy shit. Okay. That's like two a night.
You know, and you look, and he's in this huge mansion, and he's the fifth most successful entertainer in the world behind Oprah, Michael Jordan, George Lucas, and Steven Spielberg. I think he made $863 million last year.
Holy shit.
And you wonder why, how has he been number one for 35 years? Well, you're number one for 35 years because at 61, you're doing 680 shows a year. That's how. That's how you own 11 islands.
Yeah.
And so, 11 islands?
11 islands.
And actually, so, I heard it's 10. I heard one got washed
one
away.
One sunk. Yeah.
But so, yeah, so I appreciate it, and I appreciate the time. And I just want to say about you guys, which I know you guys get your balls busted a lot on these podcasts, but I just want to share with you, and I'm totally sincere, I have an enormous amount of respect for both of you. I love what you do, and I love what you've done in the comedy world, and I love this podcast. I love that last podcast you sent me. It was incredible.
Thanks, man.
And you're doing incredible work, and you guys create holy shit moments, but you also give the guests their moments, and it's really, really special.
Thank you.
Thanks so much,
man.
It means
a lot.
Appreciate that. And thanks for coming out, man. This was fantastic. As always, jlarsoncomedy.com, jlarsoncomedy on all social media.
RyanSickler.com, RyanSickler on all social media. We'll talk to you all next Tuesday.